Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is August 26th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Achy Breaky Heart, Colchicine for Acute Pericarditis. And I have a guest skeptic, Dr. Chris Bond. Chris is a clinical lecturer and emergency physician at the University of Calgary, a foam blogger, dogma basher, and food and wine super geek. Welcome back to the SGM, Chris.
Thanks very much, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you have a blog called Sock Mob. What's Sock Mob?
Yeah, it's a pretty weird acronym, but it stands for Standing on the Corner, Minding Your Own Business. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard that one before, Ken, but to me, it seems to be the most frequently reported finding when I take a history on patients with penetrating trauma. In all reality, though, Sock Mob is a website that I started as a resident. The focus was to debunk common medical myths and review the evidence for common things we do on a daily basis in the emerge. Examples include things like evidence-based laceration repair, managing CHF, and appropriately using NSAIDs. I guess you could say it's my own skeptical view of emergency medicine.
Well, you've recently joined forces with the Rebel EM to form what I'm going to call from now on the Rebel Alliance.
That's pretty awesome, Ken. It is a great opportunity to work with Salim and Swami and Matt and a bunch of other like-minded skeptics. But if we're the Rebel Alliance, then who's the Empire?
Well, clearly the evil Empire would have to be all those organizations with paywalls and barriers to the dissemination of medical information. Now, Chris, it was a recent blog entry on Rebel EM that caught my eye. You covered colchicine for the treatment of pericarditis. The Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine, or BEAM group, had critically reviewed the 2013 New England Journal of Medicine, RCT, on the subject. And I thought this would be a good way for the SGEM to use the force of social media to join the Rebel Alliance and cut that KT window down to 1 year.
You're such a Star Wars nerd, Ken. But which do you like more, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Oh, I'm a Trekkie.
So brutal, man. Can't even talk to you anymore.
Let's get started with a case scenario for the podcast here. And I've got down a 33-year-old woman presents to the emergency department with sharp retrosternal chest pain, which is pleuritic in nature. She's Wells criteria low and PERC negative. Her ECG is consistent with acute pericarditis, and other lab investigations are normal. So the question we want to answer on today's podcast is colchicine more effective in combination than standard anti-inflammatory therapy for acute pericarditis than standard anti-inflammatory therapy alone? So Chris, can you give us a short primer on pericarditis, like the history, physical, and investigations, just some background on colchicine?
Absolutely. So pericarditis is pretty simply the inflammation of the pericardium. It's all in the name, most often from an infectious or idiopathic cause. There are a bunch of other less common etiologies as well, like neoplastic, autoimmune, trauma, drugs, and radiation. But those are less than 10% of all cases of pericarditis. The classic history is positional pleuritic chest pain that radiates to the trapezius muscles. The pain is worsened by lying flat and relieved by sitting forward. Other historical clues would be concurrent or recent infectious symptoms, for example, a low-grade fever, a cough, or general weakness. On exam, there are a couple of important diagnostic findings. The first is a pericardial friction rub, which is notoriously transient and difficult to hear in my experience, but it's what we've all been taught. Fortunately, we have another physical exam finding that we can use now as well, which is finding a pericardial effusion using our bedside ultrasound. And that, I find, is much easier to do and more reliable. With regards to investigations, the ECG is the diagnostic test of choice. And the classic teaching is it shows widespread ST elevation, not fitting a particular anatomic territory. It also shows PR depression inferiorly and perhaps PR elevation in AVR. However, this is a pretty simplified description of the pericarditis ECG, And I would highly recommend listeners check out Amal Mattoo's pericarditis EKG videos, because they give a fantastic overview of ways of looking at the ECG and pericarditis. With regards to blood tests, the WBC and CRP are insensitive and nonspecific tests. The troponin is used to look for myocardial involvement, meaning myopericarditis. However, with the new high-sensitivity troponins that are coming out, we may be calling myopericarditis more in the future than we have. So to summarize, there are generally four consensus diagnostic criteria. The first is classic chest pain, the second, a pericardial friction rub, the third, pericardial effusion on echo, fourth is ECG changes. With regards to colchicine, it's a plant-derived alkaloid that functions as a microtubule inhibitor. It comes from plants, the autumn crocus or the meadow saffron. It is one of the oldest anti-inflammatories we know of and has been used to treat rheumatic diseases for over 2,500 years. Traditionally, uses of colchicine include familial Mediterranean fever, Behçet's disease, and gout. Unfortunately, colchicine also has a pretty narrow therapeutic window, so you can imagine that back in the day, there was quite a bit of colchicine toxicity.
Chris, that was a really good summary. The only way I could see improving on that summary was that you gave four consensus diagnostic criteria. There was no way you could stretch that out to five.
I know you love the number five, Ken.
Well, if you're looking for some more good information on background material, I would say check out a paper called Controversial Issues in the Management of Pericardial Disease, and it's by Amazio et al., and it's in Circulation 2010. And I'll throw up a couple of the tables. Table number one, which was the diagnostic criteria for pericarditis, and table number two, which is the recommended basic routine diagnostic evaluations for pericarditis. I think people will find that information useful if they want to dig a little deeper and have a bit more background information. But let's go to the article we're going to be critically reviewing. Chris, what's the title of the article?
The title is A Randomized Trial of Colchicine for Acute Pericarditis, and it's by Amazio et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine, 2013.
This Amazio guy, he's done a lot of stuff in pericarditis, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's pretty much done it all in pericarditis. If there's two people to look up, it's Amazio and Spodek. They're the two who've pretty much written every paper on this subject in the last 20 years.
All right, so let's start into the critical review. What was the population they were dealing with in this RCT?
So they looked at 240 adult patients from five general hospitals in northern Italy. All patients were diagnosed with a first episode of acute pericarditis. This was defined as at least two of the following: typical chest pain, pericardial friction rub, ST elevation or PR depression on ECG, and new or worsening pericardial effusion.
And the intervention they were using in this study, Chris?
They used colchicine, 0.5 to 1 milligram daily for 3 months in conjunction with conventional anti-inflammatories.
And what did they use for their controls, or what was the standard treatment they were comparing to?
The standard was ASA 800 milligrams or ibuprofen 600 milligrams every 8 hours for 7 to 10 days, followed by a taper for 4 weeks. For patients with contraindications to ASA therapy, for example, allergy, peptic ulcer disease, or anticoagulant use, they used prednisone 0.2 to 0.5 milligrams per kilo daily. In both groups, all patients received GI prophylaxis with a proton pump inhibitor.
What was the primary outcome that they were looking for?
They looked at incessant or recurrent pericarditis. Recurrent pericarditis was defined by a symptom-free interval of 6 weeks or longer after the initial episode of pericarditis. Recurrence was documented by recurrent pain and one or more of the following signs: pericardial friction rub, ECG changes, pericardial effusion on echo, or elevation in the white count, ESR, or C-reactive protein.
And then they had a number of secondary endpoints: symptoms persistence at 72 hours, remission within 1 week, number of recurrences, the time to first recurrence, disease-related hospitalizations, cardiac tamponade, and constrictive pericarditis. Now, Chris, that covers the PICO, but I think it's really important to always think about and remember, what were the exclusion criteria?
Yeah, it's pretty critical with colchicine to know your exclusion criteria, because it is not exactly the safest drug on earth. So anytime you're prescribing this medication, you should probably look up this list. Their exclusion criteria were tuberculosis, neoplastic or purulent pericarditis, severe liver disease or current aminotransferase levels greater than 1.5 times the upper limit of normal, elevated serum creatinine, skeletal myopathy or serum creatinine kinase level above the upper limit of the normal range, blood dyscrasia, inflammatory bowel disease, hypersensitivity to colchicines or other contraindication to its use, current treatment with colchicines, life expectancy of 18 months or less, and pregnant or lactating women. Furthermore, all patients with evidence of myopericarditis, as indicated by elevation in serum troponin, were also excluded.
Now, the author's conclusions were, quote, "The use of colchicine in addition to standard anti-inflammatory therapy with GI prophylaxis in the treatment of acute pericarditis reduced the rate of refractory or recurrent episodes and increased the time to recurrence when compared to placebo." So let's go through the quality checklist for randomized clinical control trials, and there are 11. So question number one, the study population included, was it focused on those from the emergency department, Chris?
We're actually not completely sure about this one. Patients were recruited consecutively through the five major hospitals, but it wasn't clear how they presented, whether it was through the emergency department, the clinic, the ward.
Were the patients randomized?
Yes, they were definitely adequately randomized.
Was the randomization process concealed?
Yes, it was.
Were the patients analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes.
And were they recruited consecutively?
Yep.
When you looked at both patients' groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, they were.
And were all the participants unaware of which group they were allocated to?
Again, yes, they were.
Were they all treated equally except for that intervention of the colchicine?
Yep.
And how was the follow-up?
It was fantastic. It was 100%. They didn't lose anyone.
Yeah, and the benchmark is 80%. And so when you hit 100%, you're doing well. Number 10 is, were all patient important outcomes considered?
I would say so, yes.
And the final one, number 11, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, it was.
All right, so let's go through those results, Chris. What was the key result?
So based upon the data presented, the NNT, or number needed to treat, for the primary outcome to prevent one case of recurrent or incessant pericarditis was 4.8, with a 95% confidence interval spanning from 3 to 11. Figure 2 in the manuscript showed the Kaplan-Meier survival curves for freedom from incessant or recurrent pericarditis.
Now, Chris, I can't let you bring up the issue of a Kaplan-Meier survival curve without talking a little nerdy to you. But the Kaplan-Meier survival curve is the probability of surviving in a given length of time while considering small time intervals. It's a standard way of expressing the number of subjects living for a certain amount of time after the treatment from clinical trials. So when you calculate it, you look at the number of subjects living at the start minus the number of subjects that died, and you divide by the number of subjects living at the start. And that's the Kaplan-Meier survival curve. Okay, that's the end of the nerdy stuff, Chris. Let's get back to the results. What were the secondary outcomes?
So there were five secondary outcomes. The first was symptom persistence at 72 hours, for which they showed an absolute risk reduction of 20.8%, or number needed to treat of 5. The frequency of recurrences, they showed an absolute risk reduction of 31%, a amazing NNT of 3. For the third outcome, it was hospitalizations. There was a 9.2% absolute risk reduction, an NNT of 11. The fourth was remission at 1 week, which showed an absolute risk reduction of 26.7%, an NNT of 4. And the final secondary outcome was the time to first recurrence, which was 24.7 weeks, in the colchicine treated group versus 17.7 weeks in the placebo group.
So these are really, really good results. I mean, the NNT from the primary outcome around 5 and the NNT for the rest of the secondary outcomes ranging from 3 up to 11. Those are really strong NNTs.
Yeah, these are some of the strongest NNTs you'll see in probably any paper.
So what do you think about this paper in general? Do you have any comments that you'd like to make about it?
This was a fantastic RCT. There was excellent adherence to drug regimens and zero losses to follow-up. The effects of colchicine were seen early and the benefits were sustained out to 18 months. Benefits were seen both in the primary and the secondary outcomes.
Now I'm going to nitpick just a little bit here because the authors report the NNT of 4 for their primary outcome. And yeah, it is 4. I mean, but when you compute it, it's 4.8. with that 95% confidence interval from 3 to 11. So really, I think we should be rounding it up to the actual NNT of 5.
Yeah, unless we're treating 0.8 of a pericarditis, I guess. Yeah, this paper was funded by the pharmaceutical industry, which they disclosed via a non-influence statement in the article.
Yeah, so I don't know if that influenced them in the rounding off, but I think rounding off 4.8 to 4 as opposed to 5. But again, I'm nitpicking here. With many randomized clinical control trials, we know that the studies are powered to show benefit. And so one of the standard limitations is that they are underpowered to detect rare adverse effects. So we won't see that in a study of this size.
Yeah, that's true, Ken. The main side effects in both groups were GI disturbances. But this difference was statistically insignificant between the groups. 9.2% in the colchicine group versus 8.3% in the placebo group. It is possible the side effects were caused by the standard therapies, though. ASA, ibuprofen, and corticosteroids are all known to have significant GI side effects. And they did give a proton pump inhibitor to all the patients in this study, but they still had this similar rate of GI side effects in both groups despite that.
So the bottom line from this study is that adding colchicine to usual anti-inflammatory management with GI prophylaxis to prevent recurrence or refractory pericarditis symptoms with an NNT of 5. The most common side effect being diarrhea, but remember there were strict exclusion criteria which limit the application to uncomplicated pericarditis without systemic manifestations or evidence of elevated cardiac biomarkers, including nonspecific troponitis. Do you have a case resolution for us, Chris?
Yes, I do, Ken. So this 33-year-old woman diagnosed with pericarditis was given a prescription for ibuprofen, 600 milligrams TID for 7 days, followed by a tapering dose over 1 month. She was also given colchicine 0.5 milligrams daily for 3 months and a proton pump inhibitor prescription for 3 months. She was also referred to cardiology for ongoing follow-up.
So how are you going to use this clinically then, Chris, in your day-to-day practice?
So in my day-to-day practice, I'll use colchicine 0.5 to 1 milligrams daily for 3 months in conjunction with conventional anti-inflammatories, as well as giving patients GI prophylaxis with a PPI. This can be used for acute non-suppurative pericarditis to prevent recurrence or refractory symptoms.
So here's what I tell patients when it happens then. You have inflammation around your heart, and it's called pericarditis. Anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or ASA can help treat your symptoms. An additional medicine called colchicine has been shown to prevent prolonged symptoms. Colchicine has also been shown to prevent pericarditis from happening again. These two types of medications, though, can be hard on the stomach, so we're going to give you something to protect your gut. The most common side effects to these effective pericarditis treatments is diarrhea. Well, Chris, that concludes the critical appraisal. How about a Keener contest on the subject? Do you have something for me?
Yeah, I cooked one up just for you, Ken. So Dave Spodek is one of the authors of the paper that we reviewed today. He is the guy when it comes to pericardial disease and is well-renowned for his work. He's actually written a 496-page textbook, which is called The Pericardium. So the question is what is the ECG manifestation of pericarditis named after Dave Spodek?
If you know the answer to this Keener contest question, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. The first winner for this year's Keener contest was Marcus Prescott knew that Sussman and Finch published the first study on thrombolysis and stroke, and it was called Thrombolysis with Fibrinolysis and Cerebral Arterial Occlusion, Journal of the American Medical Association, 1958. Congratulations, Marcus. Look for your cool skeptical prize coming in the mail soon. Now, we do have a couple of upcoming BEAM conferences. There's one in Quebec City called QBEAM, September 29th and 30th. There's still time to sign up. And then, of course, there's EuroBEAM in Prague, December 5th and 6th. Chris, I want to thank you for being an awesome guest skeptic. And we are currently working on an exciting new series for Season 3 of the SGEM. Can't spill the beans right now, but it should help cut that knowledge translation window down to even less than 1 year. Stay tuned. We will have an announcement in the near future. Until then, Chris, can you give the SGEM tagline?
Thanks very much for being here, Ken. And remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.